This is the Homestead Journey Podcast, the podcast dedicated to the pursuit of self-sufficiency, self-reliance, and sustainability. This is episode number 88 of the Homestead Journey Podcast. Welcome, 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 everyone. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join me here on the Homestead Journey. My name is Brian Wells. I am coming to you from 3B Farm and Homestead here in beautiful upstate New York. And folks, today's episode is going to be a little bit different than what I normally produce. And that is, I am actually not going to have a Homestead Happening segment. I'm actually recording this episode on Monday because my wife and I are going to be out of town on Friday and Saturday. And then we have family coming into town and we're going to be doing a celebration for my mom and dad's anniversary on Sunday. And so to ensure that I actually am able to get a podcast out to you, I am recording it before I know what happens here on the Homestead this week. So bear with me on this. I have a great interview today for this week's Charting the Course. I am actually talking with Don Bradner from Little Mountain Life. That's a YouTube channel. Don and Natalie and their two daughters are homesteaders in just outside of Front Royal, Virginia, on 5 acres of land. Folks, if you haven't already discovered them on YouTube, definitely check them out and check out their Instagram page because, folks, they have absolutely gorgeous views off of their deck. And so if for no other reason, follow them for the views. Absolutely gorgeous. But I really enjoyed this interview with Don. We talk about their, to a certain extent, a little bit unconventional path into homesteading, as well as a microgreen business that he ended up quitting. And so we talk about all of those things on this episode. It was a great conversation. I hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed chatting with Don. Don, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
And it is, I know it's a sacrifice on your part to be here. It's a sacrifice on my part to be here because I didn't take into consideration the fact that our beloved Cincinnati Reds right now are playing the Brewers.
Yeah.
It's a big deal.
If it was the Rockies, we just assume that they're going to win and we don't have to worry about it. But this is going to be an important game.
A very important game because we are above 500 for like the first time in forever.
Amen. Yeah.
And instead of us rooting on our team, we're here to talk homesteading for all of the listeners of the Homestead Journey podcast. So thank you very much for your sacrifice.
Thank you for your sacrifice.
So for those who aren't familiar with Little Mountain Life and Don Bradner, tell me a little bit about who you are and what you've got going on.
Sure. Well, currently, we are a family of four. We have two daughters. My wife, Natalie, is up here, and we're on a little mountain in Virginia.
Hold on. Let me interrupt you there. You said currently you're a family of four. Does that mean anything?
Oh, no.
Okay.
I was going to segue into like, but before, and like, I was going to do like a quick, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry to break the train of thought. I wasn't sure if there was
definitely not.
There was like this breaking news story that I was getting ready to. Oh,
nothing would make my mother more happy than to hear about another grandchild.
Yeah.
But no.
Okay. So carry on.
Yeah. So yeah, we're up here just kicking it. We're finishing up our pole barn house build. We're trying to continue kind of building up what we're doing homestead wise. And it's just, the term we use to explain what we're doing right now is a big hot mess express. And it just, we have times when we take on too much and start a project and kind of having a restart. And it's just, it's a little crazy up here right now, but I mean, even though it's way crazier than our previous life, we used to live in a townhouse in suburbia, just like normal people in suburbia, I guess, really close to like every amenity and everything. And it wasn't a difficult life at all. But, you know, I was a band teacher, middle school band teacher. I did that for 6 years. And Natalie was a church musician and trying to be a professional opera singer. And we were fine. There was really no complaints back then. She wasn't super happy with the opera singing because it's kind of like an exclusive thing to break into. Even though she had a world-class voice, she wasn't getting the higher paying gigs. So she fell into this new career in audiobook narrating. You can search Natalie Nautis on audible.com and you'll find over 170 titles under her real name. And then she has a pseudonym for some other books. But she started that career and then we kind of saw that going places. And it's hard to record audio for any job or art inside of a townhouse because you're at the mercy of the noise around you. And so we thought, hey, let's get out. Let's go get some property. If there's a house there, cool. If there's not a house there, we're going to make it happen. And we knew that she could kind of work from anywhere, but we wanted to be close enough to family that was still in the area. So we started a property search, and it especially was spurred by like three townhouses within our cluster of 10 went up for sale at like the same time. And the first one went up for like $300,000. It's like, dude, we just bought this one for $235,000. You tell them. So we just followed the crowd and left with $65,000 in profit. Just nice. Like it wasn't even hard. Like the market was the market. So we weren't complaining. We left, we bought a camper and started this whole journey up here. And eventually, kind of cutting through the story a little bit, we had a lightning strike hit the property. Many actually. I looked at the map afterwards on National Weather Service and there was 15 lightning strikes within a 3-mile radius.
Wow.
Like right here. And I guess that's what happens when you're up higher in the sky. But yeah, it fried our infrastructure and our camper. So we've kind of had to move in prematurely to our home build. Technically, we don't have that permit, the occupancy permit yet, but we have a really cool building inspector that's very flexible with us. And he kind of understands, like, you know, it's either kind of putting us out on the street, so to speak, because that camper's not going to work anymore, or just kind of let them live there while they're building. So it lends itself to a lot of challenges when you're living inside of a working construction zone. Mm-hmm. And every now and then you have to like go live in a hotel for a couple nights because you have to let the spray foam insulation, you know, finish off gassing or drying or whatever. And, you know, you run into hiccups, but it's fun. Hot Mess Express. We're doing our best up here.
So now you said that your building inspector is rather flexible, and yet he hasn't been very flexible in certain cases. So we'll get to that in a little bit, because that's really been, I think, you have a YouTube channel, Little Mountain Life, which we haven't really talked about much. We've talked about what Natalie does, not so much about what you do, which is more of the YouTube side. Mm-hmm. But I think a big part of what has drawn people to your channel has been the fact that you've been real, authentic, and the inspector hasn't always been flexible with you, shall we say.
Yeah, I mean, building inspectors are there for a good reason, I guess, like the premise of being safe with your building and what you're doing. Our first video that really blew up was when I failed a building inspection earlier on in the process. And that was actually a different building inspector than the normal one. The normal one was on vacation.
Okay. And
when he came back to do the re-inspection, he's like, looks fine to me. And so that video, you know, a lot of people like seeing people mess up. And for two reasons, they just want to feel better than somebody else, or they want to see, hey, how can I not make his mistake? Right. So I'm happy to put it out there. And, you know, and then recently with the deck that we had built by a contractor to try to save time, there was just like little kind of nitpicky things, but at the same time, it was safety related with railing issues and whatnot. So,
and if anybody hasn't seen the videos and hasn't seen pictures of that deck, that deck, it's not like it's 2 feet off the ground.
Oh no. We're on a mountain. So I mean, to give you guys an idea, from the bottom of my property, it's about 1400 feet elevation, and the top is about 1650, and it's just 5 acres. So there's quite a drop off at the front of our house. And I think, yeah, our bottom posts, looking at it now, are about 8 feet off the ground or so. Like there's almost like a livable space underneath that deck. So yeah, it's just not one of those like on grade decks. You got to be careful and make sure all the posts are set and the brackets are where they need to be. And
correct. And
with the wind up here, I was concerned about the wind kind of catching under the deck like a sail. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, I stood out there for some really heavy gusts and I don't feel it moving at all. So I think we're good mm-hmm. to go.
Good, 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 good. So you have moved out to the country. You've got your 5 acres of land. Now you mentioned that you're doing a pole barn build. Mm-hmm. And so explain to people who aren't really familiar with that style of construction, because that's been a bit of the problem that you guys have had is that mm-hmm. that's not a very common construction model in your area.
Certainly very unconventional for most areas. Pole barn house or a pole barn building, the foundation is the poles or the posts that go down into the ground. And more people are starting to do styles where they lay concrete and then do brackets and set the posts on that. But we still do the traditional way. Our posts are 4 to 5 feet deep in the ground. And foundation up on a mountain can be a little iffy. Our excavation unearthed giant boulders that are like 4 by 6 foot wide, like big boulders. So we wanted to kind of have minimal penetration, like deep enough penetration, but minimal so that we still had a strong house. And we like the look of a pole barn structure. It's very simple. We don't have any like jet outs of like additions or like weird windows sticking out here and there, bay windows. It's very straightforward. It's actually a square house. It's 32 by 32. And our gable extends 2 feet past the front, just kind of get a little overhang, but it's super simple. And it's metal siding. We chose to go with black because we kind of wanted like that modern cabin in the woods vibe. And you just think of a pole barn out in the country. And we even had the Amish build the structure itself. They came down from Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, and put it up in 9 days. And those guys know how to put up a pole barn. That's very, very fast. And that was another advantage to what we were doing. A stick build structure like that to dry it in would have taken at least 3 times longer. Mm-hmm. So it's really cool. And then another reason why we chose a pole barn, or a lot of people are getting into barn dominiums, which typically have a shop within the same structure. But we went with that because your interior walls are completely up to you. There's mm-hmm. no load bearing walls on the inside of the structure. So we even put out a video early on. We were going to have a larger master bedroom, and we kind of decided to take down the wall there and make our great room bigger, our shared space with, you know, we got the couch in the living room and then the dining room and then the kitchen. It all flows together. So, you know, by the standard that America has now for homes, it was a very small kind of footprint, mm-hmm. but we made it super tall. So we mm-hmm. have 12 foot sidewalls and a 6-12 pitch roof. And if you guys check out the videos, but it's very tall in headspace, and we were able to squeeze a loft up in the top. It's cool. It's not conventional, but at the same time, I think a lot of people, you know, when they do a Google search of pole barn, they'll kind of be like, oh yeah, I know exactly what that looks like. Everybody has driven by one of those at some point in the country, you know?
Absolutely. And one of the things that you and I have talked about before, but that I really, really do appreciate about what you do on your channel is the fact that you do keep it real. And, you know, you are honest about the mistakes that you've made, and you have a passion about helping other people learn from those mistakes so that they're obviously going to make their own mistakes. We all do, but at least they don't have to make the same mistakes that you do. And so that's one of the things that I mean, that's something I'm just extremely passionate about. Be real. You know, I feel like a lot of homesteaders, and we'll get to the homesteading component of your, sure. your life here in a minute. But I think a lot of times homesteaders, and especially content creators, have a tendency to gloss over the mistakes, gloss over the errors, gloss over the ugly parts of it. Absolutely. And you don't do that. And that's one of the things I think that draws me to watching your content. Is the fact that, you know, you're real about it. And so for me, it's not that I watch you hoping that you fail, but I watch because you're honest about the failures. That sure. makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, everything I've done in this house, I've watched a YouTube video to figure it out. Everything, mm-hmm. everything I did to renovate the old townhouse to sell it, everything I did to learn about fishing, because I used to like fish every week in a kayak. And like, you go to YouTube for information, you know, mm-hmm. it's like Google. And I mean, it's owned by Google, but, you know, so I want to be able to put out informational videos that can be of value to people. And the emails and messages I've gotten back from people are just, it really kind of puts it home that we're actually reaching people, and like people are seeing like insulation videos that we've done and be like, hey, so is it working better for you now? Because we saw it wasn't for you earlier, or they're like, you know, we're going all electric for our house, no gas. And so people are like, but you're using an electric tankless electric tankless heaters for your water. That's not what you're supposed to do. I'm like, well, it's working for me, and you're welcome to kind of try it for yourself. So it's cool to do that. And just being a teacher before, you know, I have a great passion for education and helping people, and, you know, whether they're kids or a 50-year-old, you know, building their forever home, kind of like mine is, I'm just happy to help and put out some videos that will give information to folks like me.
And one of the other things too, and you mentioned that you, you know, have had a tendency sometimes to get too many irons in the fire. And some of that has been the homesteading stuff. So kind of walk me through, you bought the property. You didn't really, from my understanding, you didn't really buy the property with homesteading in mind. Is that correct?
Certainly. Yeah. I mean, we bought it for the view first and foremost.
And it is a gorgeous view, people. Check out their Instagram. The view from that place is just amazing. Anyhow, carry on.
Yeah. So we bought it for that. We bought it to kind of get away and get our own little slice of heaven, as they say. And, you know, when you have more land to work with, you're like, well, what can I do with this? I can do things now. I couldn't have a giant garden and chickens and then ducks and then eventually pigs in a townhouse. That's just not possible. So it opens up that whole new world. And, you know, I was down, I think I was already watching YouTube videos from homesteaders before we even made the move. So like, it just, I don't know, it popped up in the algorithm and I started getting interested in it, and Justin Rhodes, So the Land, Roots and Refuge, everybody. So I watched a lot of those and I'm just like, you know what, we got a way to start growing our own food. And that's what it's all about, you know? And I got two little girls there. Let's see, one just turned 8 and the other one's going to turn 6 next month. And so if I can even give them a healthier than average American, you know, the diet I grew up on, I love my parents to death. But man, lots of McDonald's Happy Meals and lots of Hamburger Helper and that kind of stuff. So I'm trying to make it a little bit better for them. And I think that's what we want to do each generation. We want to do more for the younger ones. So yeah, we can start to grow our own food. And it's really like a novel concept when you get started with it. And, you know, I built our chicken coop before there was a house standing.
That's right.
Know, like, and Natalie's like, what's going on here? And we all know how chicken math works, and had to go back a couple weeks after the first ones came in to get some silkies for the girls to kind of snuggle with and that kind of stuff. And I mean, I don't know how many people, I think we had at most, the highest point, we had 27 chickens, and we're just a young family of 4. Like, there's no way we can eat that many eggs.
Right, right.
And then Morgan,
chicken math is brutal.
It's horrible. And then Morgan from Goldshaw Farm sent us some incubating duck eggs, and he sent some to Jack at the Mindful Homestead. And we're like, yeah, let's just try it. I bought an incubator. So what the heck? It could be fun, you know, science experiment at home. And now we have 8 ducks and 7 of them are female. We hit the lottery as far as, you know, egg the sex layers, goes. Yep. And so now we and they've been laying every single day. They just now turned off in the heat a little bit. But for the longest time, we had 7 duck eggs every single day. It's like, I can't eat all this. So we were overproducing eggs. And for a while, I was able to like take some into town and sell them and that kind of thing, give them to the neighbors. But yeah, we started doing the thing. We built some raised garden beds. I got a couple of videos on that. I kind of did like a how-to video. And, you know, we can grow food. It's just so cool. Like we had strawberries that we planted last year, and it just, that's like such a win in my book. Cause I didn't know how that was going to work out. I just put the starts down in there, ordered them. 2 of them happened to kind of survive all the chaos that is our garden. And now the girls just go out at lunchtime and they pick a couple strawberries off. And it's like, wow.
Nice.
We're making food.
Nice.
It's pretty cool.
And so from my understanding, you didn't really grow up with this as part of your background or your heritage. And did Natalie?
Absolutely not. No, I at least grew up in a small town in Ohio. It was like 7,000 people growing up. So almost all my friends lived on a farm. My best friend was at the time the number one ranked llama showman in the country. So he had tons of llamas. I went to go see them. And I had friends on, you know, cornfield farms and everything. But Natalie was even more kind of in the city. She grew up in Fairfax County here in Virginia. And it's like pretty dang close to Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think you can have chickens in your backyard in her neighborhood. And that's for sure. Even if you had 5 acres to work with, they still mm-hmm. wouldn't allow you to do that there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, she had more of a stretch to come from where she was to here. And, you know, it used to be when we were driving through the country, she'd be like, what do people do for work out here? Like, I don't get it. Like, what are they doing? I'm like, dear, they're getting by. They're doing different things. They're working different jobs. And, you know, the small town America was definitely not a thing, but it's grown on her tremendously. We're closest to Front Royal and Front Royal, Virginia, which is actually where the Homesteaders Conference is every October. And there's great restaurants and everything, but she didn't realize that. So mm-hmm. it's been a transition, but it's been a really good one.
Awesome. So as part of that, you got into microgreens mm-hmm. and, started growing microgreens for the family. Tell me a little bit about how you got into that aspect of it.
So another YouTube rabbit hole, Curtis Stone, he mm-hmm. put out a lot of microgreen videos. And, you know, there's always a get-rich scheme out there somewhere in any field, really. And I saw the potential for microgreens, and I saw the nutritional potential for sure. They just pack that nutritional punch that is really unmatched with how much you need to eat to get that. And so I thought it'd be cool to try it out. And I enrolled in one of the courses online, and they teach you everything about seeding densities and give you a little business package with logos and stuff. And just thought I'd try it out. And we had a successful commercial microgreens business for a year. Successful as in I was growing every week to give to restaurants, to give to CSA friend of mine up in Winchester. We have an awesome little farm market stand at the base of our mountain. And she's so sad that we're not growing anymore, because she especially loved the sunflower microgreens. They were really mm-hmm. good. But, you know, I made a great product and I made people happy with my product, but I still don't have a finished house. Mm-hmm. And one of those things, I just got too excited about something and I thought I could take on more than I really could. And so we've shut it down, and mm-hmm. we're going to keep growing for our family, because there's no better way to grow that nutrition in such a small space. And it just kind of fizzled out, but I love microgreens. There's so many different varieties you can do. It's really cool. Just commercials over, you know.
But I want to dive more into the whole microgreen thing, because I really want you to school people a little bit on it. Sure. And kind of the benefits and understanding what microgreens are. But one of the things you said is that it fizzled out, and I'm going to take a little bit of issue with you on that, because it really wasn't so much that it fizzled out. It's that you made a conscious decision to quit.
Yes.
And you're a quitter in the good sense of the word. A lot of times people look at quitting as a bad thing. But I think sometimes we as individuals, and in particular as homesteaders, we don't sometimes know when to quit.
Absolutely.
And there are times when for our health, for our sanity, for our financial health, our family situation, whatever, there are times when we need to quit things and walk away from things. And maybe someday we'll go back to it. Maybe some way we don't, you know, but at least for right now, we need to understand that this is not the season for whatever it is, whether it's microgreens, whether it's growing a garden, whether it's canning, whether it's raising chickens. I mean, that's another thing that this year you decided to skip was raising Cornish crosses.
Yep.
And so I think there's a sense to where, as you know, especially people who are brand new to homesteading, it's so exciting. They want to do all the things. They want to raise all the things. They want to grow all the things. Yep. And it's so easy to get in way over your head. Guilty. And if you're not careful, you're going to burn out.
Yeah.
And, sure. And, you know, and in your case, not to pick a Natalie too much, but happy wife is happy life, right? So
absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And you know, there's opportunity in all the things that you think of, you know. And I was faced with either expanding the business greatly, mm-hmm. or shutting it down, mm-hmm. because with a lot of businesses, especially when you're producing something, if you upscale, you can get more efficient. You know, mm-hmm. you have more space to do what you need to do. Your systems are a little more fluid. And so I had the opportunity to really quadruple my growing and my sales, mm-hmm. but it wasn't the right time. It was not the right season. So we made that decision, and, you know, Natalie would have supported me through it. She, mm-hmm. she questioned it many times. Are you sure you want to step back from this? Mm-hmm. Are you sure? Because she wants me to be happy. And, mm-hmm. you know, especially after I quit my job teaching, she wants me to find something that I'm passionate about and I want to keep doing. And, but that particular passion was taking too much time away from the house build, and mm-hmm. was really just, it wasn't the right time for it. So,
I think that's the key. It wasn't the right time. That's not to say that in the future, you may not go back to it. Right now, I don't think you have any plans to.
Right.
But who knows what the future holds. But as of right now, it's not the right season for you. You recognize that. And I really, really admire that about you and about Natalie and how much she supported you through that. Because, you know, I'm sure it wasn't an easy decision to make.
Sure.
But it was the right decision for you, for your family at this time. And so I just have nothing but the utmost respect for both of you in that regard. And again, I just want to reiterate to people that there are times when being a quitter is the best thing you can do. And, you know, to just keep, you know, whether you want to call it throwing good money after bad or throwing good time after bad or, you know, doing the same thing over and over and over again and hoping for different results. I mean, there's so many different ways that we can apply the idea that there are times when we just need to take a step back and quit.
Definitely.
And I actually did an episode, 5-Minute Friday. I'll include that link in the show notes. Just on that topic. Sometimes you need to be a quitter, and that's okay. And you're going to have family and friends that are going to give you crap about it. You're going to have YouTube followers that give you crap about it. But at the end of the day, you know your situation better than anybody else does. Absolutely. And so, you know, you just, again, sometimes you just got to quit. And so anyhow, having said that, let's jump back into microgreens. So
sure.
For people who don't really understand what microgreens are, I hear the term, you know, microgreen. You can grow microgreens with so many different things. Kind of walk me through the basics of what microgreens are.
Sure. Yeah. Like, defining them, a lot of people get confused that they're sprouts, and they're not sprouts. Sprouts are what you kind of do in the jar with the paper towel and all that kind of stuff. And it's not that. And it's not baby greens where it's like, I don't know, 5-6 inches tall, the lettuce or whatever. It's right in between. It's before it gets its true leaf, or as it's getting its true leaf is when you want to harvest usually pretty much any variety you grow. So it's really, really baby greens, and it kind of makes harvesting them a challenge at times because they're so small and you got to slice through with a really sharp knife, but it's just very young. And because they're so small, they don't technically need any additional nutrients other than what was already in the seed. I'm sorry. you don't need any additional nutrients because they're good to go with the seed. And so, you know, some people get really into like fertilizers and all this other kind of stuff in grow mediums. You can do them hydroponically with no added fertilizer if you wanted to. But I chose to do it with soil. I use ProMix BXM soil. You can get it in like the big bales at different garden stores. But most people grow them in what's called a 10-20 flat. And a lot of people are familiar with 10-20 flats from like seed starting and stuff. But you want to get the shallow flats for microgreens. Those shallow flats are going to A, save your soil costs because you don't technically need that much soil for it to grow. And B, like kind of like you don't want to give other things more space to kind of grow in. So, you know, if you don't have airflow, you're going to have some kind of like gnats will come in and you're going to have mold issues. So you kind of want to be minimal with microgreens. And so, you know, for anybody at home just starting out, you get like three or four of these 10-20 flats going, you're going to grow plenty of food for you and your family. You don't need a big setup like I had, and I only had two racks, but it's really good for a lot of different greens. Like we did broccoli, we did cabbage, kale, all the leafy greens, all the brassicas, and then sunflowers are delicious. Speckled peas or green peas are really, really good, very high yielding. So like you can pretty much, if you can think of it, you can grow it. In fact, I just tried it. I ordered a small packet of seeds. I grew Chinese mahogany trees in microgreen form.
Oh, and really?
Very like oniony, very interesting flavor to them. Uh-huh. And I thought like if I could get good at it, that's really something I could corner the market in and be unique with that. Cilantro microgreens, alfalfa microgreens, the list goes on and on. But you harvest at that really young stage, and therefore all the nutrients is packed into that little bit. So let's say you take a microgreen salad the size of my fist, it would take a normal salad that Americans normally eat with the big lettuce and everything, like at least a heaping plateful to match that nutritional value. Okay. There's a study by the University of Maryland that basically says the average microgreen is 40 times more nutritious, nutrient dense than its adult form. So they're really cool. Small spaces. You don't need a really fancy light. I did not use grow lights. I used standard LED shop lights that I could daisy chain up and down my shelving, put them on a timer. I flip them on. I think I had 16 hours of daylight set for them. And airflow, like I said earlier, is super important. If you have just stale air there, even if seed starting, people will probably mm-hmm. find things growing that shouldn't be growing. Mm-hmm. So keep that airflow going. Give it some decent light. You can do it in a window if you want to. But the average kind of from seed to harvest on like the brassicas and whatnot is like, let's say 10 days. We'll put an average on 10 days. My sunflowers grew in 7 days, especially when it was a little bit warm in the grow room, and temperatures will do that to you. But there are some things like cilantro takes like 24 days. Like that's kind of like specialty for a chef, but the average one's 10 days. So if you get into like a rhythm with a cycle and like plant every 5 days or whatever, you're going to keep going with them. I've seen a lot of people try them on YouTube. And, you know, there's great tutorials out there. There really are. And I'm going to do one eventually. There's a channel called On The Grow, and they break down everything really well. They're just growing in a utility trailer in their backyard in Texas. They're great. But there's a lot of people that make mistakes. Like you don't need to bury the seed. And what you need to do is you need to put weight on top of the seed after you do it. So you're doing this weird thing. You're piling on seed. Just high density seeds onto one space. And my mother-in-law, God bless her, she's from Taiwan, and she's like very, very frugal and very saving seeds and all that kind of thing. And she's like, "You're using how many seeds to make this?" And now she grows it because I got her hooked on it. But mm-hmm. she just could not wrap her mind around putting 1,000 seeds down of anything in one place and then harvesting it in 10 days. Is that big enough? But it works. And so you broadcast the seeds on there nice and even, and you take a paver on another tray and you set that down on top of that. And that what that's going to do is going to force those roots to go down right down into that soil, and it's going to strengthen. And you'd be amazed. You've got a full 10-20 flat of broccoli microgreens that you plant, and in 3 days it's pushing up that 7-pound paver like it's nothing. Wow. Wow. And they just work collectively to push it up.
Wow.
And then the only other thing I want to say is like with watering, a lot of people are used to kind of like watering a plant from above. You can't really do that with microgreens because you're planting them so dense that you would just kind of like soak all the leafiness that comes up out of there. When you do it, you have your initial tray that you plant in is actually going to have holes on the bottom of it. And some of them are mesh. Some of them have slots, but then the bottom tray is solid. So I you know, depending on the variety in your growing area, you just put a couple cups of water in there every day. And as long as the soil looks relatively damp, but not soaking wet, just like you would for any other seed starting, they grow great. But if you start kind of doing the top watering thing, you're kind of inviting some mold to grow around there. And then, you know,
then you got problems.
Start over.
So with, obviously with this, I think there's probably going to be certain microgreens that people will like, other microgreens that people don't like. So as you're starting out, and the other piece to it as well, you're not going to order your microgreen seeds from Baker Creek.
Yes.
By the packet. Like yep. That's just not going to be where you, well, I mean, you can, you're just going to spend a fortune.
Oh yeah.
So how would you recommend people buy sample seeds from Baker Creek to start, or do you need to start from, and I guess maybe the better question is, where did you get your seeds? Because you're buying them in like 5 pound wax, right?
Yeah. I was buying sunflower seed bags by the 50 pound bag.
Wow.
And other things, and usually like 1 or 5 pound bags, things like broccoli or kale. And so I did most of my shopping through True Leaf Market. They sell all sorts of gardening stuff, even greenhouse kits, I believe, and grow trays and that kind of stuff. But they kind of have the market mostly cornered as far as having good quality seeds. The thing that a really big question is, and you brought it up with Baker Creek, like what's the difference between a microgreen seed and a normal seed? It's the way they test it for germination, and it's tested specifically for microgreen use. If you have 50% germination on a microgreen tray, it's going to look sad. You're not going to be able to harvest that. It's going to be messed up. So usually you're seeing numbers like 99, 98% germination on there, and it's bulk. But they do sell smaller packages, usually like I think depending on the seed, because a lot of the seeds are really tiny, and you can get like a 1/2 ounce package, or you can get something like a pound. It just kind of depends on the seed, because like peas are very large, very heavy. Sunflower, the same thing. But then broccoli and all the brassica seeds are super, super tiny. So you can go on there and kind of see what they have, maybe get the smaller package to try out. I would say the average kind of like sample size package will grow you a handful of trays, and you can see if it's right for you. The number one varieties I'd like to suggest to people to try out at first would be sunflower. It's super nutty and very high in protein. A lot of vegetarians really love that for that. Then there's speckled pea is a really good pea variety, and that sucker will keep growing and growing, and it's cut and come again.
Okay. So, that was going to be my next question. Is every variety cut and come again, or just certain ones?
Very few. I mainly, from what I did, and I grew up to 20 varieties at different times, but peas are the cut and come again variety.
Okay.
So what I would do, since I was doing commercially, I would do my first cut, give it to the chefs and the customers. And then the next one, I would continue growing. I would kind of move it down the rack, and that would be for the family. So I'd let that grow another 4 days, and boom, it's the same height again.
Nice. Just
grown like a weed. But I would continue to do fresh ones for customers, but you know, for the homesteader, for the person at home, even in an apartment, you know, if you're starting somewhere, you can grow peas several times, and it does kind of get stringier as it goes. It's not quite as nice, but if you're just using it for nutritional intake, and just for the satisfaction of growing your own food, yeah, that's a good one to go with, speckled pea. So you have sunflower, speckled pea, and then broccoli is like the king of nutrition. The broccoli is the one that everybody says has like, I mean, I'm no doctor, but it says it has like anti-cancer properties and all that kind of stuff to really help the body do what it needs to do. So broccoli is a really good one, and it's super easy to grow. So I would try those three first, but watch some videos on YouTube, check it out. And like True Leaf Market has grow guides listed with each seed variety. It kind of tells you what you need to do. But there's a lot of websites out there that tell you the seeding density, how long it takes for it to germinate, and then how long you need to have it under lights. And then one other thing that's like a big thing is a lot of people don't know to black out those seeds as they're coming up, and they pushed off the paver, and it's like, oh man, these babies are ready to rock. Then you flip over a solid tray on top of them. And what it is, it's the opposite of seed starting in a normal sense, because you don't want them to get leggy. But these you kind of do, because as I mentioned earlier, they're really hard to harvest. If you don't give them that blackout period, they'll stay down close to the soil And then you're like really trying to cut there and then cut yourself. And you're like, well, can't sell this to customers now.
But, a little extra. You know,
and even if it's for yourself, you don't want the taste of your own blood. So,
right, right. Yep.
So yeah, you want them to grow up that extra little bit. And, you know, a lot of people kind of neglect that and they're like barely getting a harvest and you get more yield, you know, when it comes down to it. It gets taller. You can cut and not be cutting right at the base of the leaves, but you can go down the stem a little bit. And you know, especially if you're like juicing them, a lot of people like to do smoothies and whatnot. You want as much to grow. So usually, let's say for broccoli, well, for all three of those varieties, sunflower, peas, and broccoli, I would germinate for 3 days and they'd be stacked underneath the paver. Then I would black them out for no less than a day, sometimes two. And then they go under the lights and then I watch them to see when I can harvest. So, you know, that 10-day cycle is 3, 2, and then 5 days under the light at the end. So yeah, that's fun. Yeah.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned, and I think this is really important because as you know, I'm very, very passionate about particularly people in small spaces and people who are just kind of getting started, you know, people who are, you know, kind of on the fence about growing food, maybe who live in the townhouse, live in an apartment. This is a way that people in a very small space with a relatively inexpensive setup can grow some nutrient dense, great tasting food.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's really easy. Small spaces are the way to go. Absolutely.
The other thing that I wanted to mention as well, and I don't know if I've shared this with you before, but you were part of the Homestead Journey challenge that I did back in April. You graciously came and spoke. And thank you very much for that. But sure. You actually inspired one of the members of the Supporting Listeners program to try out microgreens. And
awesome.
So she's been doing that. I'm waiting for a full report. So Jenna, waiting for that full report on your microgreen experience. But so you've already inspired somebody within the Supporting Listeners program to take that leap. So
that's so cool.
Thank you so much. And it's something that really I've been thinking about wanting to do and just haven't gotten around to doing it. But it really, you know, you've really piqued my interest in. And the thing that's really exciting to me about it is I already have some of the stuff to do this because I start my own seeds.
Absolutely.
And so I don't have the shallow trays. I've got the deep 10-20 trays. So I'll need to get some of those shallow trays. But other than that, I've got the racks. I've got the grow lights. Like I've got, I might even have some pavers kicking around. I'll have to get them out of the pig pen and wash them off. Okay, maybe I don't want to use those ones.
A couple bricks, maybe.
Maybe I'll go invest in some brand new pavers, not dig the ones out of the hog pen. But it's something that certainly people can do, you know, when this, you know, most of the year, my rack and my grow lights sit empty. Just kicking around doing nothing. So it's really a way that you can take that investment that you've already made in 10-20 trays, in grow lights, in racks, and grow more food.
Absolutely. Year round. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people that listen to this, I'm sure, are big time gardeners. But depending on your climate, if you're where I am, you're not going to grow, you know, a lot of leafy greens in the middle of January. You're just not going to. Up there in upstate New York, you're not going to.
No. But... yeah. Unless you want to put up, right now it seems like everybody's putting up high tunnels.
Yeah.
It seems like every, just about everybody with a YouTube channel, except for Little Mountain Life and the Mindful Homestead have put up high tunnels. And I haven't, although my YouTube channel is really more the podcast channel, but, definitely without that or, you know, some other kind of low tunnel or whatever in upstate New York, you're not doing that. You're just not doing that throughout the winter. And so certainly this is a great option for people if they're wanting to grow food, just even during the wintertime. Okay. Yep. You're getting your lettuces, your spinach, that kind of stuff during the summer. Mm-hmm. And you want to go with that and you're busy doing all that kind of stuff. Then fine. Don't grow the microgreens then. But then in the wintertime, when you're not wanting to slug through the snow, and shovel things off to be able to dig down to whatever it is you've left in the garden. Great way for you to continue to grow food.
Absolutely. I mean, if NASA can grow microgreens up on the space station, you guys can do it in whatever house, apartment, whatever you're doing, you've got the space for it because they're doing it right now. They've got studies going on. They're growing microgreens for the astronauts up there. So you guys can too.
Absolutely. Well, Don, I mean, we could keep talking for a long time, but you know, let me check the score here real quick. What's the score? Looks like right now it is 1-1 in the top of the second. So
we have a
ball game to watch here. Well, you're going to watch it. I'll listen to it. Mm-hmm. And but thank you very much for joining me. If people want to find out more about you, where can they find you?
Yeah, so we're pretty much on all the social media. Like we've got the YouTube channel, Little Mountain Life. And you can find us on Instagram. It's technically Little Mountain_Life because somebody took the other one. We have a Facebook group where folks follow us there. So we're all over that. My wife, if you're into audiobooks, you can look her up on Audible. Again, it's Natalie Nottis. She uses her maiden name because Nottis is way cooler than Bradner. But but she uses that. So you can check her out there. And if anybody is coming out to the Front Royal, Virginia in October for the Homesteaders of America conference, I will be happy to meet anybody there. I'm actually going to be doing the filming for the Homesteaders of America. I'm going to put up their YouTube videos for them and edit them and do all the interviews of the speakers and the workshops. And it's an amazing event. They're probably going to have about 4,000 people there. And so if anybody in this audience is listening and they're going to be there, definitely make sure you find me when I'm using my camera and say hi and, introduce yourself because I'd love to meet as many homesteaders out there as possible.
Excellent. Excellent. Just don't get in the way too much of what he's trying to do. But definitely stop by and say hello. Well, Don, thanks again so much. It's always a pleasure chatting with you and go Red Lakes.
Go Red Lakes. Thanks for having me.
Catch you later. So Don, thank you so much for joining me on this episode. Folks, I hope you enjoyed that. I really had a blast chatting with Don. Don and I have become friends, although we have not yet met in real life. Rarely a day goes by that he and I don't chat. And so thank you again, Don, for being on the show. Don and I have many common areas of interest besides just homesteading. One of them, as we said, was our beloved Cincinnati Reds, who currently are batting in the top of the third, up 4-2 on the Brewers. So hopefully they keep this rolling. But you didn't come here to hear baseball scores. So if you want to find out more about Little Mountain Life, Don and Natalie and their family, I will have links to all of their social media accounts in the show notes. I will also put Natalie's at least maiden name in the show notes. Hopefully I will be able to link to Audible so that you can just easily click on it and find it. But I will include that in the show notes as well, because if you're somebody who is into audiobooks, it's a great way for you to help support Don and Natalie as they are living out their homestead dreams there in beautiful Virginia. Before I close out the show, in my conversation with Don, I did mention the Supporting Listeners program. So if you are interested in checking that out, head on over to support.thehomesteadjourney.net to find out more information.
Brian can be reached by emailing him at brian@thehomesteadjourney.net or by contacting him via our social media accounts on Facebook, Instagram, or YouTube. If you've enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support this podcast, we invite you to become a member of the Supporting Listeners Program. For $10 a month or $100 per year, you will receive access to a community of like-minded individuals via a private Facebook group, at least one monthly live Q&A with Brian, the opportunity to participate in live recordings of the podcast, access to an ever-expanding library helpful homesteading content, and so much more. Head on over to support.thehomesteadjourney.net for more information and to sign up today. As always, the music on this episode was provided by audionautics.com. So a big shout out to them.
And until next time, everybody, keep up the good work.